I can't even hear one bar of that music without feeling a jolt of childhood delight and anxiety. Every fall when I was growing up in Nebraska, my siblings and I would sit down for the annual viewing of the movie. It was like a holiday ritual, one I look forward to a lot more than some actual holiday rituals.
I'll get you, my pretty.
And so even today, 40 years later, almost any random sample of that soundtrack transports me back to that universe of fantastic twisters and flying houses and munchkins and flying monkeys and witches and Dorothy and Oz.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm not alone in this reminiscence of things past. Almost everybody, I think, has their own set of intense, indelible Wizard of Oz moments.
I was certainly drawn to the witch.
The director Neil LaBute first saw the movie when he was growing up in Spokane, Washington.
I realized the power of the close-up, and when she became, you know, larger than life, I can remember backing away toward the kitchen.
Can I still have my dog?
No!
The novelist Salman Rushdie first watched the movie in a theater in Bombay when he was 10. Years later, he sat down with a videotape and watched it over and over and over again.
I fully expected by the end of it to detest the film. Instead, I liked it much, much more because it showed me things, that process, which I had never seen before.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in Studio 360, we are plunging deep into this American icon, taking you down alleys and roads in Oz that you've probably never traveled before.
I don't like this forest. It's dark and creepy.
Before the 1939 movie and the songs and the other movies and the Broadway musicals, Oz was conjured in a single book, adored by hordes of children in the early 1900s. The book was written by L. Frank Baum, who at the time was the editor of The Shop Window, a trade magazine about retail window displays. The 1900 edition of the original Wonderful Wizard of Oz, with drawings by the newspaper cartoonist W.W. Denslow, sold for $1.50 and flew off the shelves at virtually Harry Potter speed. Baum went on to write 14 more Oz books over the next 20 years. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky has the story of the real man behind the curtain.
Lyman Frank Baum failed at every career he tried. He couldn't make it as an actor. His newspaper flopped. He couldn't sell crockery. In the Depression of 1888, he opened a general store in South Dakota and sold gourmet chocolates and Japanese lanterns.
Baum was literally a rainbow chaser.
Michael Patrick Hearn has spent most of his life studying L. Frank Baum. He says Baum was a classic overachiever.
Nothing could be done second rate. If he was going to open a store, it was going to be the best store. If he was going to sell axle grease, it would have to be the best axle grease. If he was going to sell chickens, they had to be purebred chickens.
Baum had one clear talent, telling stories. The kids in the neighborhood would follow him around like he was the Pied Piper. He didn't think he could make a career out of it.
And his mother-in-law spent her winters with the Baums, and she said, "You better write these down, Frank. You're a fool not to."
Matilda Jocelyn Gage may have convinced her son-in-law to write The Wizard of Oz, but her influence on Baum didn't stop there. She was a pioneer in the women's rights movement, partners with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, until they had a falling out. Gage has been largely forgotten by history, but you can see her radical feminist ideas all over Baum's work, especially with the character of Dorothy.
She's thrown into the situation, and nothing's going to keep her from solving her problems. She even loses her temper, and that's why the Wicked Witch is destroyed, is because she loses her temper and throws a bucket of water on her. This is a pivotal moment in children's literature. It's the first time a child is allowed to lose its temper and not get punished for it.
The books were popular, but Baum didn't really hit it big until he turned The Wizard of Oz into a Broadway musical in 1902.
All of the things that poets sing, the sweetest place regarding.
Baum had finally found success, but that didn't make his life any easier. He tried to end the Oz series after 6 books and move on to other stories, but they just didn't sell. So he decided to build a franchise out of the one thing he got right. Baum moved his family to Hollywood in 1909. The movie industry hadn't even started yet. Baum's Oz films were some of the first motion pictures made in Los Angeles. and he cast unknown actors who would later become the very first movie stars, like Harold Lloyd, Oliver Hardy, and Hal Roach.
What was interesting about the films is that everyone had an original score, which was almost unheard of at this time. And this was like the first scoring of motion pictures. In California, it had an orchestra. In New York, it had an orchestra. And then I guess in smaller towns, they would have people playing the piano. But it was not a success.
Baum even tried to sell dolls of the new characters as part of the ad campaign for the upcoming books, musicals, and movies. He was doing everything Disney would try 10 years later. But Baum couldn't pull it off. Like Disney, Baum understood the future of entertainment. But his business sense hadn't improved since he tried selling Japanese lanterns to South Dakota miners. Baum's family remembers him as the eternal optimist, taking his failures in stride. But even they admit that his real home was in his imagination. Michael Patrick Hearn wonders if Oz played an even more important role for Baum.
No one creates a secondary world like the Land of Oz who's happy with the world as it is. I think there were a lot of things that Baum was not happy about his life and about America, and a lot of that gets into the Oz books.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.